So. I'm still hungry. So, what is happy about being hungry? So, can anybody tell me what is the missing thing? See, we have to demarcate this line. Well, we are almost there.
Falsifiable
statement. So I will add one more thing here. Falsifiable statements. So do you understand the meaning of falsifiable statement? That means if you make any claim or whatever you assert in science, it's possible that it is false. What do you mean by that? That means
there is a chance that it can be proven.
No, what you have to do is you have to construct a world, think of a possible world in which the events that the theory would deduce can be proven to be false. So that means you must find out some event that must happen, that could happen, not must happen, that could happen in that possible world. Some kind of a false kind of thing. Take, I'll give you an example. If Einstein's general theory is correct, then there exists a phenomena such as bending of light as a possible event. So bending of light is a possible event. So if light doesn't bend, then Einstein's general theory would be false. So the theory should predict some falsifiable consequences. So that is the meaning of falsifiability. So you should have falsifiable consequences. So if you can deduce falsifiable consequences from any theory, you can call it falsifiable. So do you have falsifiable consequences for all the theories that you know? What would be a falsifiable consequence for Newton's theory? Yeah, maybe gravitation. Take the gravitation.
Sir, they don't attract each other with that force given, which is inverse square law. These two bodies will not be attracted by the force which is given by the inverse square law.
Okay, is that proven?
Yeah.
Has it been falsified? Yeah. Is inverse square law falsified? So then how do you say that that's a falsifiable thing?
That we can falsify.
You can falsify it.
If we got something, if there is some particular which requires it, then that's
it. No, does it require that there should be no repelling objects? Is that the consequence of the theory? Not necessarily, right? Because the charge can be right. So it only talks about the mass. That's
so if you find any mass which has no charge, then it is wrong.
So has it been falsified that way? So then what is the falsification? Do you know any thing which cannot be solved because of Newtonian dynamics? Why do you think that Newtonian dynamics cannot explain all events in the world? What happens then?
the laws are modified, he is the...
The laws are modified in the sense that there are certain constants. You take certain things as constant. So the constants are no longer constants because they become variables. Because they, the constant itself changes because of them.
Assume that non-distance forces will take place with distance force, that phenomena, but it is not true, and gravitation force will also travel to
the details apart, I want you to understand what is the meaning of falsifiability. What is the meaning of falsifiability? Falsifiability has a very clear meaning. So, suppose if I propose some theory and that theory has become false, does my that theory become science because it's falsifiable, or it's even falsified, not just falsifiable? Therefore, all false theories must become science?
Falsifiable means if we observe something that is not in sync with that theory, then we can reject the theory. It is false according to that theory.
Well, but then we have lot of examples. We have never rejected theories because they are falsified. Fine, and let us take Newton's theory itself. Classical mechanics doesn't explain so many things.
Not rejected.
We don't reject it.
The statement we can check whether it is true or false.
So essentially, one of the most interesting things, I mean, falsifiability is something to do with being rigorous. Lot of people don't understand this close connection between being rigorous and being falsifiable. What does it mean? I'm talking about something, and suppose I don't even give you criteria of what that something is, then how can you falsify? That means speak clearly of what you're talking about. Make your points explicit. Okay, if you're talking about something, under what conditions can I get that thing? Okay, what are the conditions under which that phenomena can be replicated? If you don't specify, then it can't be falsified anyway. So that is what we mean by the, so you have to clearly specify the meaning of falsifiability. For example, people have criticized Darwin's theory of evolution as not a falsifiable theory. Why it's not a falsifiable theory? Because it is unclear under what circumstances natural selection would not happen. So you said what is natural selection, but you haven't said what is not natural selection. So what is it to be not a natural selection? So you have to clearly specify what is it to be not natural selection, as well as what is it to be natural selection at the same time. That means you haven't specified an explicit definition. So you haven't given a very clear definition of what natural selection is. So as a result, what happens is whatever happens is has happened because adaptation took place, and therefore natural selection took place, and that's why that species is existing. So for anything, any species that is existing, you say it has happened, it is existing because it is naturally selected. It is adapted to the environment. It is adapted to the conditions under which that thing is there. So on this basis, natural selection is still considered to be an unfalsifiable thesis, a theory. So what does that tell you? That means natural selection is still not sufficiently rigorous. So there are still some scientific theories which are not sufficiently rigorous. So one may make another attempt of explaining exactly what you mean by natural selection. So people have tried different formulations. It is still not considered a closed problem. I mean, of course, not in science, but in philosophy of science, this problem continues to be an open problem. So, but in lot of things like quantum mechanics is rigorous enough, because you know exactly what they mean. Therefore, when some activity happens, some thing happens, you exactly know whether, you know, you should say whether it confirmed or disconfirms the kind of verification. There are very few cases where, you know, people have conducted the experiment several times, looked at the results and still not being happy about, you know, which way to interpret. So once the results are clear, you very clearly know, okay, this interpretation is false and that interpretation is right. So that means when you conduct an experiment, that experiment clearly gives you a solution, gives you a it resolves a problem. So an experiment should resolve the problem. So whenever such resolution actually is possible, you'll say that particular piece of knowledge is really, really falsifiable. But that falsifiability is impossible if you are not rigorous. So being rigorous is a condition for being falsifiable. So if you haven't specified all the conditions explicitly, it's not possible for you to give a falsifiable theory. So these are some of the things.
Sir,
but as I told you, yes.
Sir, if a statement is rigorous, then what is the meaning of
false? No, if you are making something rigorous, what you are doing is you are also, see, because you are being rigorous about something about the world, right? Because we are talking about, so what does it mean? That means you are using concepts which are well defined, right? That is the meaning of being rigorous. So if you are using concepts which are well defined, that means using those well-defined concepts, it's possible for me to reproduce that phenomenon. If you are not well-defined, then you will say, no, that's not what I meant.
Sir,
you may always say, you know, where suppose somebody does an experiment and say you are wrong. Okay, then immediately you will say, okay, that's not what I meant. This is something else. But if you have clearly defined your meaning, then you can't say that. That's the meaning of being.
Rigorous statement should be not falsifiable.
No,
because it cannot be
not necessarily. No, rigorous statement and not falsifiable are not related. Only thing is that being rigorous is a prerequisite for something to be falsifiable.
So falsifiable means proving something false.
No. Probable to be false.
So if you are rigorous, like mathematics.
Yeah.
At least theoretically, it should be possible that you can disprove it.
Yes.
But like if you theoretically cannot disprove it. We need not do it in, I mean, even if you conduct for the experiment, also it should be falsified.
That means you should very clearly say under what conditions, okay, you get this result. That should be very clearly specified. There should be no ambiguity. So that also tells you, falsifiability also tells you that there should be no ambiguity about your claims. So as is the case, for example, Darwin's theory is ambiguous in the sense that, you know, whatever may happen, you'll say, well, it happened because there was an adaptation. A lot of people don't agree, but then it still remains an important problem because there is no very clear statement, a very clear rigorous statement about what Darwin's theory is. Of course, we also don't have a very clear mathematical formulation of the theory as well. But a lot of simulations, etc., have been worked out based on certain formal theories of natural selection, where we take certain things like fitness landscape or something like that. So you have certain other definitions of what it is. So the other important point that falsifiability also brings in, some of the other things also talk about, is that it should be empirical. Now, what do you mean by being empirical? So, being empirical requires you a little bit of thought, in the sense that being empirical essentially would mean that it's not logically true. So, if something is logically true, then that's not empirically true. So, something as simple as, for example, it should not follow from the definition itself, something like, suppose if I do 2 plus 2 is equal to 4, if you already know what plus is, if you already know what a 2 is, therefore, I mean, if you know the meaning of the operation addition, and if you know the meaning of what 2 is, then you know that it is going to be 4. So here you have very clear follow. But then this statement cannot be called an empirical statement. So 2 plus 2 is equal to 4, you may call it science, but I won't agree. I would say, well, it just follows from the definition. That is still not what I would call 2 plus 2 is equal to 4 is science. So 2 plus 2 is equal to 4 again is not falsifiable. Doesn't mean that that's not science. I mean, it can be part of science, it can be made use of, because I mean definitions are required for you to conduct some inquiry. So scientific claims cannot be of the kind that 2 plus 2 is equal to 4. The claims have to be different. The claim of science has to be different. And that's why we call it then empirical. So we call it empirical. So to be empirical means something that should not be known to be already already true. I mean, if you just know that it's already true, I mean, there's no point talking about it. In other words, something like this. Suppose if you know, you already know that some things are always true. So if something is always true, what is the probability of that statement to be true? One. And if something is false, and it's always false, what is the probability of that?
Zero.
So if something is empirical, it has to be between 0 and 1. That is to say, science is never about 0 and 1. The scientific truth cannot be 1. It can be closer to 1. It cannot be 0 either, because that's utter nonsense anyway. So it can't be 0, but it also can't be 1. That's very important. So science may make use of certain statements for conducting its exercise, those statements which are already known to be true, but you are not pursuing towards that. Your pursuit is to find out what are those which are here in this range. You're trying to find out those statements which are closer to one and not absolute one. If it is absolute one, it's not empirical. Like most definitions are like that. So we are not really trying to talk about such statements. The statements which are already known to be true, there's no point to conduct an experiment about it. You don't have to conduct an experiment to, for example, do 2 plus 2 is equal to 4. You won't have to do something like that. So it has to be something close to that. In fact, the moment you say something is close to this, that is, the value is only between 1 and 0, that means essentially what you're saying is that it is. So suppose if something has 0.8 as a value, what does it mean? That means that it is probable, the probability of that statement is that much. So there is a likelihood that that may become false. So which essentially means that in the whole world of possible events, okay, that statement will come out to be true only under that situation. Now that makes almost everything quite empirical. You can possibly say anything that happens and then you can say it's science. That only makes it empirical, but that doesn't make it science. If it has to be science, then what you have to do is you have to also make it rigorous as well as empirical. That means you also have to say under what conditions it will be 0.8 probability. In fact, that's exactly what we do in statistical mechanics. A lot of events that we describe in using statistical physics, we are using statistics, but then we actually say what is the probability of that event. So if you say, for example, the probability of this event to happen is about 0.4% according to your calculation, and your experiment says that it is 0.4%, then you are doing science. So that is also the interesting feature about this particular character. But I'm still not talking about that being the point that I'm going to be really happy about. I'm still not happy, because even these are not enough for me to talk everything about science. Well, that point is not so easy, because of the fact that it is difficult to characterize. But in the recent past, people have come to some kind of unanimity that most scientific propositions, most scientific facts have an interesting character, and that is you simply can't get a scientific fact from mere observation. No fact of pure observational character can be called a scientific revelation. So that's why it's called counter intuitive. Intuitive here means intuition is essentially able to observe perceive. That's the sense in which it is used. That means your common reason, your common sense. So being intuitive means being common sense. So what is one of the interesting characteristics of science which has not been spoken so far is that it's not common sense. Science cannot be common sense. If it is common sense, it might explain common sense, but science is not so easy. There's some very interesting character about science that if you have loads of common sense, you will never produce science. So loads of common sense will not give you science, which essentially means, of course, that you have to be creative. That means you have to somehow cross common sense. You have to cross intuition, common intuition, such that you can start doing science. Now, what do we mean by that? I'll give you a few examples. After that, I'll ask you to give more examples. By the way, do you know any examples of science where science told you something counterintuitive? That, I mean, people at large don't want to believe you. They feel that, okay, I don't want to believe you. I mean, it's something absurd. I mean, what is this?
So, like the Earth revolves around the sun.
Yes, very, very interesting. So, Earth revolves around the sun. I mean, that's not what I see. That's not what is common sense.
Earth is
round. I mean, I see Earth is flat all the time. So, common sense is Earth is flat. But science tells you that it's a sphere.
Relativity
is completely counterintuitive. Now I want you to come out with something worthy of science which is intuitive. And you still want to hold it as science. Benzene ring is intuitive. What is intuitive about benzene ring? No, but in what sense it's intuitive. I mean, if it is intuitive, then possibly everybody would have smelled benzene and said, you know, the rings would have come in the mind. That's what we mean by intuition, right? Because whenever you have an aromatic smell, you know, you should have rings in your head. Then it's intuition, right? But that's not the way. I mean, it occurred to only one person. What do you mean by intuition? Maybe what you mean by that is that it was in his imagination, it was in the creative. Creativity and imagination is not what we mean by intuition. Intuition is essentially something like, you know, intuitive. Being intuitive is low degree of intelligence. Being at an observational layer, simple reason, common sense, common logic. It's not part of common logic that you generally talk about it. In fact, various things that we have been looking at are generally not taken to be as a part of science. Can you come out with any other examples?
Counterintuitive.
Examples for counterintuitive. In science.
Usually, intuition is considered as higher form of intelligence.
No, intuition as in you know, some kind of intelligence, some kind of creative aspect. When you are talking about counterintuition, the term when you are using counterintuition, you are talking it as more than common sense. It is used in that sense, something above observation. It is possible for, you know, somebody to use the word intuition in a creative sense. But then when you are saying that, you are saying that, you know, other people don't have intuition, I have intuition. All that, when you are trying to make that point, you are saying that I'm above common sense. So the use of the word intuition, of course, is very ambiguous. It's not a very clear thing. But when you are talking about counterintuition, we actually mean something about it. That essentially means we are not talking about common sense. So science can't be built out of common sense. So if you have loads and loads of common sense, you can never make science. In fact, that is also one of the most important reasons why teaching science is very difficult. It's not so easy to make everybody a scientist. You have to actually do a lot of paper pencil work in order to believe what people are talking about. So why? Because you also have to imagine a lot. If you don't imagine, unfortunately, science is not possible. Whether it is theory of evolution, you need loads of imagination there, because evolution itself is an imaginary concept, because nobody has seen it. It doesn't occur to you in your observation. And the same is the case of any of the most interesting physical phenomena that we are talking about. Like what you see in nature is what most people believe. For example, people have been talking about, suppose somebody had cold, well, there is a weather change, so he had a cold. I mean, if you want to ascribe cold to a virus which is not visible, it's not part of intuition. So the theory, like, you know, germ being a cause of a theory of something requires enormous amount of intuition. Of course, you need a lot of experiments to prove it. That's a different thing. But then the hypothesis that you start with, the hypothesis that you begin your enterprise with, the assumptions that you make in order that the science begins are all counterintuitive. There are still a lot of counterintuitive things that you still have been talking about in science, but you're not telling me those examples. That's also imaginary thing. It's not intuitive that the matter is made of things. I mean, if that was, well, you might say that, well, I mean, you can say, you can break sand particle into small things, you know, it's so intuitive to look about it. Then what about breaking water? I break water, I still get water.
Sir, all the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, they are what you count
them. Pauli's exclusion principle, for example.
Paradox.
So very, very paradoxical. Some of quantum mechanics, foundations of quantum mechanics are still completely counterintuitive. I mean, utterly absurd sometimes, because your common sense doesn't allow you to accept any of those things as your first principles. But then it works. All your experiments are conformed to those things. So the first principles of science are all counterintuitive. You're still not telling me some of the first principles that you have learned which are really, really counterintuitive.
Gravitation.
What about the first law of Newton?
Yes,
The inertia is completely counterintuitive. Now, what does it mean? Common sense cannot give rise to that kind of theories. Those theoretical imagination doesn't come from common sense. So if you have, you know, tons and tons of common sense, you can't produce Newton's theory. It requires some other kind of abilities. Certain other things are involved other than intuition. Certain other things are involved other than simple observation. Maybe some of the things are already here, but we don't know. But the most important thing is that this is certainly not interesting. So average people just simply can't accept that thing that, you know, if you don't move this, it will continue to be in its state of motion. So that requires you to, you know, come up with some very theoretical, very imaginative constructions. So can you name more such things from the science that you already know, which made you think that okay, this is really, really absurd when you first heard about it? Including, for example, the current statement that I am making. Like suppose if I say that the definition of science, one of the defining features of science is that it must be counterintuitive. Suppose if I say this itself is counterintuitive, and therefore it becomes science because I said it's counterintuitive. Well, I mean, let's not get into that absurdity, but the point is that can you think of some other counterintuitive?
So light travels with a finite speed.
That's also counterintuitive because everybody before that thought that, I mean, it's due to simple, if you apply mathematical induction, you know, there must be speed higher than, because there is no logical problem of thinking about a number that is bigger than the speed of light. That's because you assumed that light travels in straight line. Sound requires medium to travel. Maybe. See that you need a medium to travel is common sense. What is difficult to think about is action at a distance. See, action at a distance is something that is talked about in science very commonly. I mean, we always because you know that there should be some medium for something to travel is very intuitive, because you always, that's part of your intuition. Whereas the counterintuition would mean action at a distance is counterintuition. I mean, if you really want to be like the way how Thales thought science should be constructed, then these are really, really counterintuitive, because you can't simply construct these things out of you know, your simple faculties that are given to you. So you need to have many of these things. So in fact, this is some of the important things. In fact, this is a very, very recent revelation of philosophy of science, and also a lot of scientists nowadays agree, including Feynman, for example. The reason being that earlier almost everybody thought that science comes out of observations. In fact, there is a very famous logic called inductive logic. People thought that all the laws of science and the theories of science come from inductive reason. That means the hypothesis that the scientists arrive at come from inductive reason. Now, if you really have to find out due to inductive reason, let us say the first law of Newton. So tell me, what kind of experience I need to have in order to have the first law of Newton? Can there be any experimental?
Sir, for that, if we leave an object with some velocity, then if we observe that it is not being affected, the motion.
No, is that actually a possible observation ever? That's a theoretical observation, not a possible observation. So that means, see, induction essentially means empirical. It must be, so some event should happen, like this crow is black, that crow is black, that crow is black, therefore all crows are black. Or there is force when I applied this much, there is a force when I applied this motion as well, therefore you say that force is a necessary condition for all motion. You know, whenever you make such statements, you say that it is an inductive generalization. Even to say something like, for example, all matter should have extension. That means whatever is material must also occupy space. Can you may think that that's also an inductive generalization. Not a problem, but that's not counterintuitive. You know, to think that matter has extension is very commonsensical. Everybody will accept. So that's the whole idea about it. Suppose even if you want to say that, you know, irritability as a characteristic difference between, you know, living and non-living matter, even that everybody will accept. What is so counterintuitive about it? Therefore, that part of biology is not really science, according to this definition. Because where you are not really defining what life is. Because all that you are doing is you are just describing what everybody knows. and just codifying it and then putting it together, and maybe you're just making it systematic. So just doing systematic science is not really science. Take for example, you have done a beautiful classification of all the animals and plants by observing lots of things. That is really not science. But still, there is a counterintuitive element. Even in, for example, Linnaeus, the science that Linnaeus used. What is the counterintuitive thing about Linnaeus? Like everybody, for example, was trying to classify animals and plants, for example, on the basis of the size. Okay, these are trees, these are shrubs, these are this. But then that didn't get you a class of similar things. What do you mean by class of similar things? Because classification is to get a class of similar things. So give me a characterization on the basis of which I would be able to come out with similar classes. Because classification can be done inductively. Take a character and obtain a class. So what should be the character that I should use in order that I get common classes? On what basis can you think about it? You know, for example, touch me not plant?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What is it?
When we touch,
is it a shrub or a herb or a tree? It's basically a herb. It's a very small, a small plant. But all its relatives are big trees. All the relatives, that means all other characteristics based on, for example, the kind of leaf that plant has, the kind of fruit that it produces, the kind of flower it has, the kind of roots and the various anatomical features of that plant, though it's small, you know, the rest of them all are very big trees. Mimosa trees, for example, we have some of them in the campus, and not this one. The one opposite, we have a big mimosa plant out there. So that's a very big thing. And both of them actually are very close. That means they both fall under the same genus. That means two species, one of them is a herb, the other is a big tree. So how can you explain that kind of a thing and say that put them all together in one class? So the criteria on the basis of which you have to put them together should have some kind of a theoretic intuition. So Linnaeus had that kind of theoretic intuition. And what he said, the structure of the flower should decide under what class the plant should be. He said, leaves, I am not worried. The properties of leaf is not really my importance. The properties of trunk size or size of the trunk or where it lives, whether it lives in Africa or in Europe, I don't care. As long as I see the flower has the same kind of things, it should all have the similar features. The rest of the things will fall very nicely. So as soon as you see the floral characteristics, you don't have to look at anything else. So by looking at the floral characteristics, he was able to predict what kind of root it will have, what kind of stem it will have, what kind of fruit it will have, whether the seeds will be at the center of the axis or at the periphery. He predicted everything just by looking at the flower. So that's the characteristic feature that you should have. But that has to come from not observation, it has to come from theory. So he made a big theoretical hypothesis, which of course happened to be true. So you should have that kind of, intuitive abilities. That is also true, for example, even in the animal classification that people did. Even there, a lot of taxonomy is also quite theory ridden, you should say. So you should have to come out with really examples of science where it's completely inductive. Very rare to see any such science, I mean, you would call it worthy enough that you can study it in your BSc level. You might study a lot of science in your early days, say in your primary school or in the middle school. You call it as science because, you know, okay, you have to do some lot of observations, you have to do a lot of things, you have to collect a lot of things, you have to do systematization. You are told to taxonomy, do the observations, grading and things like that. You have been doing all those things. You may also do a lot of activities and you call them experiments. We know now that they are not actually experiments because there is no control. Because every activity that is done in the lab is not an experiment. So that definition we can't accept. So that's the reason why. So finally we are coming to something important about this thing, that is that if you don't have an element of imagination, you cannot call it science. Now do you accept it? Now if you think that science must have imagination and not empirical, so being empirical is not enough. Being empirical would mean it has to come from observations. It should come from the lab. What I am now saying is that if you don't apply imagination, if you are not creative, you simply can't do science. Because otherwise this counterintuition cannot be accepted. So do you all agree? So does it describe science? Now given now all these characteristics that we have, can we now put science in this place? This is the whole body of knowledge. Maybe all this is the valid knowledge. Out of this valid knowledge, now we'll have to apply all these criteria. So I would possibly give, you can also give stars to these things, but some of them are actually redundant. Which of them are redundant?
Falsifiable
and empirical can be actually made redundant, because it's not possible that you know something is actually empirical. So all that you need is, suppose if you combine this with this, so once you combine rigor with either empirical or falsifiable, you always end up with saying the same things. So once you have accepted this much, so reproducibility is actually a result of being rigorous and falsifiable, and reproducibility usually happens in a experimental kind of conditions. So in a sense, you're actually coming closer and closer to some kind of a characteristic feature of science which gives you certain things. But then there is something very important about it, that is, we just saw that you know creativity, imagination are so important for science. Now when you are saying that, you have to now think about it. What kind of imagination do you need for science? Is it possible for us to simply say imagination is important, therefore just freak out? I mean, you can have a dash of drugs and you can be very imaginative, isn't it? I mean, so will that make you scientific? You can try. I mean, we already know that a lot of scientists, you know, have lot of funny habits. Many of them smoke. They have large number of lot of caffeine consumption is very well known. So that means there must be some relation between caffeine and science. So why are these people producing science? Because they are drinking coffee. So should we add coffee here as a criteria? So let us try to be a little more specific about it. What kind of imagination do you need in order that you produce science? Can we add a little more substance into that imagination and make it something that you can practice? Is it possible to give training to somebody and make him scientific? Yes or no? How many of you say possible? Okay, I'll repeat the question. The question is, science needs imagination. We can actually accept it. Now the question therefore is that, is it possible that I can train somebody to have scientific imagination? How many of you think it's possible? How many of you think it's impossible? Few of you, and some of you are neither here nor there. not committed to any of the things. You are not committed to any of the things?
No,
it's possible. Okay? So, but do we know? I agree, I mean, so some of you who don't agree with me have a very strong reason to think that science must be in the genes. You're born, I mean, you have the ability to do science. You're born with the scientific imagination or whatever that you need is already with me. I mean, I don't think I can convert any Tom, Dick and Harry to become scientific, or maybe Ram Rahim or whatever, if you don't like Tom Dickie.
So actually it is not impossible, but up to what extent we can induce scientific imagination.
But okay, fine. I mean, you are a little ambivalent, but then I accept your case. I agree that it's really, really very difficult to do it, but then it's possible. Fine. Granting that it is possible, you should know first of all what is it that you have to do. In fact, one of the mandates of Homi Bhabha Center is to find out that. That's why we have such a big organization where we are actually trying to find out, okay, what are the things that are required in order that, you know, scientific imagination can be increased in the population. We all know that, you know, good science would mean good economy. You know, all those generalizations that people have made, because all organizations which are more scientists have also been economically doing well and things like that. So we have got some correlations. We thought that therefore development would require more number of scientists. But how do you increase the number of scientists? If you have a trick, you can tell us. Yes? What is that? No, I haven't heard your joke.
Scholarships.
Scholarships, yes. So give them more money. It'll become imaginative. What will you buy with that money is the interesting thing that we know.
Coffee.
What is?
Coffee.
Coffee. Coffee is so.
Thinking about how it happened.
So what we need to do is, it's not trivial. In fact, I mean, just to identify what are those things which will make scientific imagination possible is not a trivial question to answer. But then we are just getting to know a few things. We still have to know a lot of things. So if you know them, possibly what will happen is the schools and colleges will be different. So that will require. So whatever is happening is happening. Why? Without a clear understanding of what science is. For example, science was there even before people thought that counterintuition is one of the characteristic features of science. Even when people thought that falsifiability is a characteristic feature of science, science was still happening in the world. But it's happening as a matter of fact. Is it actually possible that science can happen without awareness? It can happen without awareness. It can happen without explicit idea that somebody can actually do scientific things without actually realizing that he is doing science, which is also possible. Okay, just as for example, my stomach doesn't have to know the chemistry of digestion in order to digest some food. It just happens. So similarly, it's also possible for science to happen like that. But then one of the things that we accepted about being scientific is that if you really have to be scientific, then you should be rigorous, which means that we should know under what means that we need to know. We need to know what are we doing, who are we, what makes us different from the other disciplines. In fact, that is one of the most important reasons why this question becomes a very important question of what science is, and in what sense is counterintuition a very important characteristic feature of science. So, is it something that historically clear to us? If we have seen some episodes of various examples that you have seen. you know, starting from Thales to Alexandria. Can you give examples there? Tell me who was most rigorous of all so far? No, only up to Alexandria. You apply this knowledge now to what episodes that you already learnt? Archimedes was rigorous?
Yes.
Yes? Was Euclid rigorous?
Yes.
He defined everything?
He
defined everything, right? He defined what a point is, what a line is. Right? You defined what a triangle is. You know, everything was very rigorous. In fact, that's a good example of being rigorous. And then, what about other things? What about observations? And what about being empirical? Did they do anything empirical? Or what kind of experiments did they do?
Thought
experiments? What thought experiments did they do?
Find the volume of all sphere.
Volume of?
Sphere.
Was it a thought experiment?
No, that was not a thought experiment. Sir, but making those
making that concept, that concept, saying that, you know, it's a limit,
yes.
You know, that is like this is the closest way that you can reach, but there is a best way to reach it as well, you know. So those things are really, really very interesting thought experiments. So did Archimedes did conduct a lot of thought experiments, and he has done a lot of experiments as well. For example, how did he solve the crown problem? The crown problem, of course, was also requires you to have some kind of you know, counterintuitive idea. What is a counterintuitive idea in the crown problem? What is counterintuitive about the crown problem? There is some important discovery that Archimedes did. Possibly one of the first such properties that Archimedes invented. What was it? Not really. That's not really such a. No, I am talking about he discovered a quantity. Yes. I mean, in today's terms, we call it specific gravity, because the notion of mass is not used at that time. He uses it only from the point of weight. So that's a very, and what is so interesting feature about that? It is in difference to other kinds of quantities.
The density is same kind of
substances, and that is actually called intensive versus extensive quantities. You know the distinction between intensive and extensive? So this density is one of those quantities. And today we know that it is one of the first intensive quantities that has ever been discovered. So in the entire history of science, so the very first intensive quantity that has been well defined is density, or specific gravity in Archimedean language. So that also happened during that period. So therefore, you do see already that much of science has already happened. So there is a lot of counterintuition. Is there any counterintuition in Thales or Anaximenes, Anaximander, Democritus? Do they have a theory?
Yes.
Do they have imagination?
Yes.
Now the question is, do they have scientific imagination? But we may not know what scientific imagination is as yet. But still, do you want to agree? Do you want to grant any scientific imagination to all the people that we have so far done? Which cases do you grant scientific imagination?
Plato's idea of defining everything.
Okay, Plato's idea of defining everything is a very important thing, because, for example, if you don't accept Plato, you can't be rigorous. What do you mean by rigorous? Means define everything. Yeah, so that was like what you can call the fountainhead of all science. like that's like a like the beginning of the whole thing, which is that if you don't accept that, I mean the whole thing doesn't make sense. Yeah, it's got a sort of given some kind of a I would call it an agenda item. It's agenda, or in other words, a manifesto. It's a manifesto point for science. And what is it? That is, if you want to be a scientist, okay, for every physical phenomena we should have a physical cause. So that would be a kind of a point out there. So you accept some of them. Why am I asking you? Because you have to think in these terms. So when you are, for example, writing and characterizing people of the past, you have to use these qualities, you have to use these concepts to describe. These are what you call interpretative descriptions. If you are doing history of science, you have to use these descriptions to describe what people's achievements are. You have to use them to say, you know, like suppose you want to say, you know, somebody is crazy. So craziness is a description for that person. Just like that, you know, if somebody is very imaginative, you'll have to say, you know, in what terms? You'll have to say somebody is very imaginative. We discussed earlier, for example, some of the things. The case of Aristotle, for example. So, was there imagination in Aristotle? Which was not science? That's what I was asking.
That was kind of philosophy.
Such as?
Density. I mean, in which he was telling that water belongs to water and air belongs to
air.
Yeah,
attraction. Oh, like attraction.
Like the worldview. So, we discussed the Aristotelian worldview. Okay, now is that worldview, does that worldview come out of experience like that, or does it require imagination?
It is not counterintuitive.
It is not counterintuitive?
No, means yes, sir. Is that the we are seeing the is many things here get hold that force is required to move out. That is
right. So that is what is generally accepted even in the history of science. So most of the things that Aristotle said are not counterintuitive. They're mostly intuitive. They're mostly from experience. But all that, of course, he has done wonderful systematization. There is no doubt about that. So he has done enormous amount of systematization of so many things that have been known. But there may not be so much of counterintuition. But there may be certain things where he has done really, really counterintuitive and very, very highly imaginative things. And but that happens in logic, not so much in otherwise. So logic of Aristotle is really a lot of imagination, enormous amount of construction, is built like an architect. It was built with a lot of planning, the whole thing, and everything should follow from that. And we still don't dismiss entirely Aristotelian logic, and we have incorporated most of it. We have assimilated most of it. We accommodated Aristotle's logic, and therefore we won't consider it completely out of place. So you have to now have a sense of appraisal. What do you mean by sense of appraisal? You should be able to appreciate, or you should be able to criticize on the basis of what you know, whatever has happened so far. So when you talk about Parmenides, for example, did he contribute anything, or just a sense of belief? Or what about Zeno, who has introduced a lot of paradoxes and sort of confused people maybe? Did he contribute anything?
Yes, sir.
So what did he contribute?
Yes, sir, he did. So actually, he is almost like started calculus. Actually, he was pointing towards the limit from his examples.
So, see, these are like, you know, some of the early notions of, for example, infinitesimal can be understood, you know, or for in other words, you know, applying mathematical logic, particularly mathematical induction. You know, Zeno, for example, wouldn't have got a mathematical, it's because of mathematical induction that there is a paradox, that he applies mathematical induction, therefore there is a paradox. And many of the things are quite counterintuitive. even in terms of believing that some, you know, something has to be an atom, which, you know, for example, you don't see atoms in the world, and you have to construct the world out of nothing. And so such things are very, very counterintuitive. And one of the other interesting feature is that why did Aristotle deny the existence of atoms? Again, because he was against counterintuition. He was trying to say that counterintuition should not be there in science. That's why there should be no vacuum. We will see after we come back after the mid-sem, we will be talking about some arguments that Aristotle gave as a break point for conducting the modern science. Certainly, because we will have to jump now all the way to 17th century. So we have now, what we have to do is that we have to see, we have to keep in mind all these characteristics, features. Of course, the point that being experimental requires to have control should not be lost. But I am not writing it explicitly here, because to conduct an experiment is to conduct an activity with some control. That's a definition of an experiment. And therefore, I am not writing it separately. So with all this kind of a background, with all this kind of baggage, now what we have to do is, we have to now come to look at what we today call the modern science. So whatever we have done so far till before the mid-sem is what happened previous to 400 years. Now what we are going to do after the mid-sem is what happened after the 400 years. So we will be starting with Galileo after the mid-sem. And then whatever has happened before that is whatever has happened before the 400 years. Of course, we haven't covered everything, because we have missed, I said, we have just left a lot of ground. We are not doing anything of that happened in Arabia. We haven't done anything that happened in China. We haven't covered anything that happened in India. So there is a lot of bias, a lot of injustice done to all these places where so much of scientific contributions were there. So, but then even when you want to talk about, for example, science in India, again, you know, you have to bring in all these characteristic features, trying to see like which of those Indian contributions required so much of mathematical imagination or creativity, who did experiments, what kind of experiments did they do, you know, what kind of rigor did they use. So you have to use all these examples also in when you try to go and look at, for example, Chinese science or Islamic science or Indian science or Hindu science or whatever science that you talk about, you'll have to apply and try to see. So keep these parameters as very important descriptions. So if you use these descriptions and start looking at various examples, you'll start doing a little bit of history of science and also a little bit of philosophy of science as well. So these are the characteristic aspects of that. So just to come to the little bit of tips for your exam. In your exam, of course, as I already said, just giving a lot of information doesn't add up to your thing, unless the question specifically asks for that information. You don't have to provide any information, but you have to be interpretative in the sense of, you know, use all this vocabulary and whatever we have started using in terms of the previous lectures. So look for a list of questions on Friday, and also look for assignments. There may be a new piece of assignments to be added, particularly for the Alexandria part. Some assignments will be added. So the questions will come from assignments and from the list of questions that I'm going to put on. Okay, if there is any question that will still be included in the question paper and not part of assignment and not part of the list of questions, that means it needs only common sense. That means you just need only a presence of mind when you have to reply to that question. Okay, so that's about it. Now I wish you all the best for your exam. That's it. So we'll meet now when?
March 2nd.
March 2nd?
4th.
March 4th. 4th of March. Okay.